When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
From the Times and the Sunday Times, this is The Story. I'm Luke Jones. It dominated our news for years.
The British people have spoken and the answer is, we're out.
It saw off Cameron.
I will do everything I can as Prime Minister to steady the ship over the coming weeks and months. But I do not think it would be right for me to try to be the captain that steers our country to its next destination.
And May.
I will shortly leave the job that it has been the honour of my life to hold. I do so with no ill will, but with enormous and enduring gratitude to have had the opportunity to serve the country I love.
And yet there is still so much to uncover and understand about Brexit. Tim Shipman from the Sunday Times has been its most devoted chronicler, and his latest book out now is number 3 of 4, No Way Out, Brexit from the Backstop to Boris.
The clearest thing that I got wrong when I was writing about this at the time, and I think most of the British media did, was to view the European Commission as the bogeyman and Juncker as this sort of deranged federalist drunk.
The story today, the tears, plots and mating porcupines of Brexit.
I'm Tim Shipman and I'm the chief political commentator of the Sunday Times.
So you started out writing this political trilogy. It's morphed into 4, such was the amount of material you had. You enjoyed Theresa May's leadership. I read you writing somewhere twice as long as she did. Do you get some kind of a medal at the end of this?
I would like to think so. Hopefully people buy the books and that will be the reward. But yeah, I wrote 2 books in 4 months back in 2016 and 2017. And this has now taken 6.5 years for what was supposed to be the concluding part of the trilogy. But we've ended up with so much material.
Yeah.
And that was why it took so long, really, because the sort of end of it kept just retreating into the distance. And I was never quite able to catch up with events.
And give us a sense of the scale of the research that you had to undertake over those years.
I probably spoke to pushing 100 people for the first couple of books. I've done pushing 300 for books 3 and 4. I think for the first book, I had about 800,000 words of transcripts, which turned into a 240,000-word book. I had 3.5 million words of transcripts this time round. And because people saw that I was able to get the inside track with the first couple of books, I think most people were quite keen to make sure that they got their side of events across. The number of people who said no, I could probably list on the fingers of one hand. And some of them have given on the record interviews elsewhere, which I've been able to kind of cull from. So we've got most views represented in this book.
It's an interesting question of timing, though, isn't it? Because is it too close to events for some of these people? Are they still in a dark room shaking in a corner, or are they willing to talk about all of this?
Well, I tend to find that the sweet spot for getting people to talk is kind of after they've left power, and about 2 or 3 months after they've left power. So once Theresa May was kicked out in sort of June, July of 2019, that sort of autumn was a very rich period for talking to Theresa May people. They feel able to speak once they've left, but they also need a little bit of sort of decompression time. And it goes from being a sort of immediate trauma to something where, you know, some of them will want to try and find the good things in what happened, and others will want to make sure that they sort of get their side of the argument across. Memories are very strange, fickle things, and they fade quite quickly in my experience.
And do you get the sense that this is people offloading to a therapist or spinning to a historian?
I think there's different people are come at this differently. There are incidents where I guess I have to just say, this is one side of it and this is the other, and there's a dispute. That doesn't happen very often. But I think for most people, probably sitting down with me for 2 or 3 hours is the first sort of moment of actually unburdening themselves to someone who kind of vaguely understands what they're talking about. Because if you have an actual therapist, you have to explain what on earth you're going on about. Whereas with
me, the Malthouse Compromise,
I kind of know what the Malthouse Compromise is up front, and we can talk in, you know, get into the weeds quite quickly. And I think, a lot of people do find it quite cathartic, actually. And they feel like once they've told the story once, they've kind of got it off their chest a bit, and they can come to terms with it themselves. But yeah, there's certainly an element of trauma with it all, and it's quite useful to be the therapist to Westminster sometimes.
So this is book three. What is the time span you cover? Where do you start?
Well, book two ended with Theresa May signing this thing called the Joint Report, which is what created the Northern Ireland backstop. And at the time when I wrote book two, it seemed like this was a kind of hurdle crisis that she had to clear to keep going as Prime Minister, and it didn't matter too much what the detail was. Well, it's very clear that that was the sort of foundational error of her premiership, really. I mean, there had been others beforehand, but it was the one that created the problems that she was unable to resolve.
Well, I think it's important, and this is what I find frustrating about what Boris has said, is that you're talking about this backstop in this way. The backstop is a guarantee for the people of Northern Ireland.
And a week later, serendipitously, Dominic Grieve won the right to a meaningful vote. So those two events are where this book starts. And frankly, they're the two horns on which Theresa May found herself impaled for the 18 months that followed.
In what way?
Well, Northern Ireland became the sort of centrepiece of Brexit, and it became the thing the Brexiteers began to rail against, because the implication of that joint report was that unless we could get the EU to agree to some kind of technical solutions for monitoring the border, there was going to have to be some kind of alignment where Northern Ireland paid attention to EU rules. And that then began to separate Theresa May from the Brexiteers, who initially had thought she was kind of on their side. I don't think Theresa May was on any side to start with. She just felt that she had to show that she took Brexit seriously because she hadn't voted for it, dug herself into a hole. But this was the moment when the hole became too large to climb out of. And the rest of the story really is it's a process of her negotiating with the Cabinet, then with the EU, and then with Parliament. And she found herself ultimately on the wrong end of certainly the last two of those negotiations.
And what do you think her failings were? Because it's interesting in the book you write about how there are points where sort of all the ministers in the Brexit department tell her to do one thing, recommend one thing, but she does something else. And also many people not even knowing what she herself thinks in all of this.
No, I've interviewed sort of more than 260 people for this book. And I would say that with the exception of one or two of her close aides in Downing Street, pretty well nobody who sat in a meeting with her, MPs, ministers, people in Brussels, special advisors, MPs, none of them really had a clue what she was really thinking.
I remember asking her at Chequers at a lunch, will you do what you say you're going to do? And she just looked at me, because I said, I want the truth from you. And she looked at me in the eye and said, Richard, Brexit means Brexit.
She didn't give a lot away in meetings. She often didn't sum up. Cabinet, because it was so divided, she let everybody have their say, but never really kind of committed herself one way or the other. And it took her a long time, I think, to work out what she was trying to achieve. In the end, the Brexit she wanted was one where we were aligned as closely economically as we could in order to preserve sort of supply chains and the economic links, but one that allowed her to control immigration. And I think the thing that then loomed was she realised it, because of this Northern Ireland conundrum, that it was becoming a threat to the Union. And that, I think, that became maybe the number one reason for her why she tried to do what she did. But throughout it all, she also put trying to keep the Conservative Party together pretty high on her list of priorities, which wouldn't have been on the list of priorities for the rest of the country. I mean, I think arguably and ironically, Theresa May lasted probably quite a lot longer as Prime Minister than she perhaps ought to have done. And one of her successes for a period was to be sufficiently ambiguous that she kept the different wings of the Conservative Party sort of vaguely on the same page. But she did that by not really saying what she believed or what she was planning to do. And in the spring of 2018, she pivoted to a sort of much softer kind of version of it, didn't really tell anybody, negotiated it sort of fairly privately. David Davis, well, he had a decent idea what was going on. He certainly wasn't
taking... He was the Brexit Secretary.
The Brexit Secretary. And he he was not really taken into her confidence. And even in the week of the Chequers deal, which is where she finally shows her hand and the cabinet finally come to an agreement, 5 days before it, Davis had no idea what the customs plan looked like and heard about it first on the Today programme.
So that's the shenanigans on the UK side throughout all this period. I'm interested in where the power lies on the European side, because for a long time we were all obsessed with Michel Barnier, who was the negotiator on behalf of the European Commission, correct me if I'm wrong. And yet he doesn't seem like, actually, in your book, the person who moves things along. People had to go round him to get things done.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the clearest thing that I got wrong when I was writing about this at the time, and I think most of the British media did, was to view the European Commission as the bogeyman and Juncker as this sort of deranged federalist drunk.
Who was the president?
Who was the president. And Martin Zellmayr, who was his sort of civil service sidekick in Brussels. You know, he was known as the monster of Brussels and was seen as this sort of wicked enemy of Britain. And certainly at times he put our feet to the fire and, you know, he wasn't terribly helpful at a lot of moments. But by the time you get to the sort of autumn of 2018, these guys kind of realise they've almost done too well in these negotiations. They've put her in a hole. And actually, the real axis of power was between Oliver Robbins on our side.
Who's Theresa May's negotiator.
Exactly. And Martin Zellmayr on theirs. And they were meeting secretly on the rooftop of hotels in Brussels and going for private dinners miles from where, you know, most sort of EU people congregate in Brussels, and having sort of heart-to-hearts and spending 2 hours talking about their families and then getting stuck into, well, how do we get around this particular problem? And Juncker and Zellmayr basically ultimately told their own negotiating team what to do.
To the fury, you reveal, of people like Michel Barnier.
Yeah, I mean, Barnier was very doctrinaire and kind of stuck to his mandate. And even in the room, it wasn't really him negotiating. It was Sabine Weyand, his deputy, and Stephanie Risso, who was the other sort of right-hand woman. But if you read Barnier's sort of memoir, he's written this supposedly his diaries. I mean, how much of it's a diary and how much of it's been reconstructed is anybody's guess. But he keeps repeatedly saying, he sort of alludes to this at various moments about these wicked Brits who kept trying to go behind my back and create a different negotiating channel. And he has a bit of a pop at Zellmayr on one occasion. I'm told that these diaries were heavily edited by the EU, who didn't want quite a lot of this stuff getting out there. But actually, he keeps saying, oh, these Brits, they kept trying to go around me, but they didn't succeed. And he says exactly the same about David Frost, who was Boris Johnson's negotiator when they were doing the trade deal in 2020. And on both occasions, he must know that the truth is that the Brits did get around him. And
he threatened to resign at one point.
That was the moment with Boris Johnson, who was sort of going... By then, Stephanie Risso was the right-hand woman of Ursula von der Leyen, who had succeeded Juncker. And they were being smuggled in and out of each other's offices in a way that Barnier didn't know what was going on. A lot of the Brits would kind of were acting as sort of decoys. So Barnier would be sort of hovering around, and one of them would go off and have a chat with him about, you know, the Winter Olympics or whatever else it was that he was enthusiastic about. Or a young female civil servant would be, you know, would sort of accost him in the corridor and say, oh, Michelle, you must talk to me about X, and would sort of distract him while these other things were going on. And on one occasion, Barnier got wind of this and used a waiter to send a message to von der Leyen saying, essentially, if you don't let me in the room, I'm going to resign. And von der Leyen's not really very interested in having him in the room at this point, so the meeting breaks up. And then she goes off down a back staircase with Boris Johnson to continue talking while Barnier is sort of flapping around outside.
Okay.
So there's this sort of deeply farcical scenes of this. But the same thing happened with May and with Johnson. And the road to Brexit is littered with the corpses of British prime ministers who think Angela Merkel and the Germans were going to save the day by stepping in and imposing some kind of rationality. And, you know, the member states were, if anything, much more hardline than the Commission was. But the Commission, who everyone thought were the sort of the wicked witches of the West, were the ones that were actually trying to help us. And this, you know, has a bearing on how it operates over there. Mm. And if Keir Starmer's going to go and try and, you know, do another deal as Prime Minister, there's a few lessons he can learn from some of the stuff I've uncovered, I think.
Coming up, the Labour and Tory Brexit deal, which never happened and which was born out of mating porcupines. We'll explain in a moment. This weekend, Times subscribers can catch the latest episode of Inside the Newsroom. It's our new behind-the-scenes series on Apple Podcasts just for subscribers, and you'll find it on the Story feed. Visit thetimes.co.uk/bonuspodcasts to find out more.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm David Baddiel. I'm a writer and a comedian and a Jew.
I'm Saeeda Varsi. I'm a businesswoman and a politician and a Muslim.
Jews and Muslims always seem to be in the news or on the news. Lots of people talk about us, and this is us talking about ourselves.
The kind of things that people say don't touch, yeah. We are going to go there.
I mean, I think Jews and Muslims are talking about these things, but I think they're not talking about them together because they're worried that if they do, sparks might fly. A Muslim and a Jew go there.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
It's interesting that the received wisdom has always been that Brexit has taken this long and was so drawn out in its conclusion because it was just so inherently difficult. Whereas actually, it seems like what you're saying, it seems like the reason it was held up for so long was because of the failings of some of the personalities and the personal relationships. And actually, if you inserted ideal politician X on the British side and ideal politician Y on the European side, it could have been sorted out sharpish.
Well, I don't think sharpish is quite the right way of looking at it. I mean, this was a dastardly complex business, and it was one that nobody in Britain really understood, including the senior civil servants who had not really prepared for it. Mm. David Cameron told them not to, and they listened to him. One of the senior people on the EU side said to me, it's the job of politicians to say you mustn't prepare because it might leak, and it's the job of officials to ignore that and get on with it. But we didn't. There were inherent contradictions in some of the positions that were adopted. Politics is about solving problems, and these were problems that were not easy to solve. But if you look at the history of Northern Ireland, pretty intractable problems there, and arrangements have been come to over the years, and arrangements were come to over this. I think what it's taught me, talking to all these people and really getting into the weeds of this extraordinary period, is that politicians need to be a bit better at politics, frankly.
Mm. And actually, there were some examples of that in your book, where even people in Jeremy Corbyn's cabinet and Theresa May's were having secret talks to actually engage with each other.
Once Theresa May had lost the meaningful vote, she then resorted to talking to the Labour Party. I mean, some people think she should have done that a lot earlier. And as a result of that, to try and make these talks work and come to a deal, there was a group of Tory MPs and Labour MPs and some sort of former aides who'd worked with Corbyn but were now elsewhere, who kind of all got together behind the scenes. Oliver Letwin and Nick Bowles on the Tory side, Lucy Powell on the Labour side. Michael Gove was heavily involved because he was in the talks and was close to Bowles. And there was a WhatsApp group called Mating Porcupines, which is quite a good description of trying to get Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn to come to an arrangement. I mean, I think quite a lot of, particularly the staff around both leaders, Seamus Milne, Andrew Fisher on the Labour side, Gavin Barwell and others on the Tory side, I think they got quite close to an arrangement. There is a written text of what they agreed. In the end, both sides concluded that they couldn't sell it to their own parties by that stage, and that actually if it got put up, probably it wouldn't get a majority in the Commons because both would have so many rebels. You would have a sort of common interest in the middle, but the sort of the people who had got into the trenches in both parties would probably vote it down. But that document exists. I've seen a copy of it. the reason it got so sort of protracted and entrenched was because the cabinet of this country did not have an agreed position on what we were trying to even ask for until July the 5th or 6th of 2018, which is 2 years and 2 weeks after the referendum result, which is an astonishing thing, really. Mm. What was needed was some leadership where someone said, this is where we're trying to get to, because most people in Britain, I think, in 2016, 2017, were willing to be led. They were willing to be told what Brexit is. There was a pragmatic case to be made. And Theresa May, A, didn't seem to know what case she wanted to make. And by the time she did, nobody was in agreement with her. And I think you have to go back a very long time, probably to Ted Heath, to find a British Prime Minister less able to empathise and communicate with the British public.
You see, when you answer in that way, and I understand you do answer in that way, people are saying, this is the Maybot. This is what people say about you. Do you find that personally difficult if people try and present you in this way as if you have no feelings?
I don't think... I'm certainly somebody with feelings. I don't recognise that characterisation of myself.
Interestingly, though, the Prime Minister who gets closest to achieving that, actually having a unified position on Brexit and having the leadership to push it through, you say, is Boris Johnson. Him and Dominic Cummings, in the early part of their relationship in power, were the sort of most successful that we've seen.
Yeah, that's right. And everybody who worked in Downing Street, including all the civil servants, said it was refreshingly clear what everybody was trying to achieve. A lot of people didn't like the tactics they used to achieve the strategic goal, the prorogation and all that kind of stuff. It was pretty messy constitutionally. And the first 6 months of Book Four is all about how they push things through in a, you know, I think a very clear strategic political fashion where they knew where they were going. They agreed how they were going to get there. And because of everything that had gone before, Johnson, who was much more persuasive and had a much stronger argument, was able to persuade the country that they wanted to go with him. I think a good 15% of people, so maybe like a third of people who'd voted Remain, just wanted it done with by then. And that's how he got the large majority in 2019. But then, of course, it all fell apart.
So if even that, which started as a success as you see it, fell apart, the starting success of Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings fell apart, Theresa May fell apart pretty much from the start, is your conclusion from these four books and all this research and all this time spent in that era that we have a worse class of politician than we should have or have maybe ever had?
I tend to avoid kind of being that apocalyptic about it. I think we had a whole series of really difficult problems. Politics is kind of really simple, but it's also very, very, very complicated and very, very difficult. No politician, no prime minister can have all the skills that you need. The key is to work out what your weaknesses are and to employ people who can compensate for them. And Boris Johnson clearly did that in the second part of 2019. But once he fell out with Dominic Cummings, he then allowed himself to sort of do what he felt like, which was not nearly so effective. I think it's easy to look back at the past and say these people were titans. And I think a lot of people who see David Cameron now in the cabinet, including a lot of members of the cabinet, think that he's a bit of a class act and is rather better than the four people who succeeded him. There's a very, very good prime minister to construct from Boris Johnson's sort of political abilities and communication abilities, Rishi Sunak's diligence in the detail and the documents, Theresa May's sense of public service, and Liz Truss's sort of chutzpah and kind of, you know, what you might call balls, for want of a better word.
A sort of Mr. Potato Head of different...
That would be a very good prime minister. Yeah. Unfortunately, all of them were lacking in their different ways. And David Cameron obviously was as well. He made a massive strategic error, and the first thing on his obituary will be that he was the Prime Minister who took us out of Europe against his own will.
But I'm just thinking that as we look to the future, we've got all these enormous challenges, different in flavour from Brexit because they're not as sort of technically negotiation-minded, but we've got health service in crisis, social care's in crisis, we've got these big black holes in the government finances, problems in the courts and the rest. You would look at this period that you've written about and maybe think, gosh, do any of these people have the skills necessary to actually sort out these big, knotty issues that require compromise and the rest?
Look, I think what the big picture conclusion has to be is that if a leader is honest enough about what the problems are and is upfront about what they're trying to do about it and presents a pragmatic kind of argument about why they want to do what they want to do, people will kind of listen and give them a chance. But they've got to be clear about that, and they've got to be sort of authentic and honest about it. And I think if you look at Keir Starmer, who we assume is the most likely next prime minister, I think you'll look at this book and think his position evolved a bit over Brexit, over whether he wanted to have a referendum. But what he was very organised at was at working out where he needed to take the Labour Party and where he wanted to position himself in order to become the next leader. That was quite strategic and tactical and effective, and he ended up being leader. A lot of people still don't really know deep in his soul what he stands for. Is it the stuff he's been doing? Is that the same as what he believes? Is that the same as what he'll do, particularly if he has a large majority where there's not going to be a lot of challenge externally? And most of the challenge will come from within the Labour Party. There's a lot of people in Labour ranks. We don't know how good they're going to be as leaders. We have no idea, for the most part, whether these people will be competent secretaries of state. There will be people who are quite well known, who've been big figures, who've done a good job in opposition, who literally couldn't organise a booze up in a brewery, can't make decisions, all that sort of thing. And there'll be people we've never heard of who will emerge as very competent, reliable ministers. And we don't yet know their identities. And the question for Starmer will be, how quickly can he adapt? You know, Gladstone said the top job of a good prime minister is to be a good butcher, and that means cutting out the dead flesh. And, you know, Boris Johnson's downfall was arguably because he wasn't prepared to do that with people he liked. Theresa May never forced the cabinet into sort of making difficult decisions. When she did too, she lost a couple of ministers. But Johnson, Truss both had cabinets that were much more kind of, you have to support X if you're going to be part of it, and that brought a sort of ideological clarity, but it didn't necessarily mean the best people were around the table. So there's trade-offs in all of this. I doubt even Keir Starmer quite knows how he'll behave when he gets to those decisions. I mean, I, you know, have lunch with a lot of these sort of backroom guys and some of the front benchers, and they sort of occasionally, the Labour people will say, well, you know, you've got any advice? You know, you've been around for a long time. And I say, whatever you think it's going to be like, multiply it by 10 and then by 10 again, you have literally no idea what's about to hit you. You've had the luxury of time to think. You've not had to make 10 decisions a day, and particularly in number 10, it's very difficult to keep that strategic focus and deal with whatever's just coming at you that day. And I think Brexit meant that people did not have the time and headspace to do anything else, and we didn't even deal with that terribly well. So I think it's a lesson in the difficulty of politics, but it does show that we need good people, and they need to learn the lessons. They should read this book, frankly.
And if they don't, it'll be ample fodder for the next four books.
And that will be great for whoever it is that writes them. But it won't be me, I think.
Fair play. You've done your time.
I've done my time, and my family's done their time as well.
Yeah.
My two young daughters have never known anything other than Daddy writing this terribly long book. I'll have a crack at some fiction next, I think, which will be easier to do.
Stranger than fact, perhaps.
I mean, the great thing about the last 10 years is that fact has been stranger than fiction, but there's quite a lot in my notebook that, legally speaking, I would find difficult to get in the book. So it'd be useful to write a novel where one could explore some of those themes.
Fabulous. Tim Shipman, thank you very much. Tim's new book, No Way Out, Brexit from the Backstop to Boris, is available now to purchase. You can get it at the Times Bookshop. We've put a link to it in the notes of this episode. Every week, Tim takes Sunday Times readers right into the corridors of power with an absolutely essential read about what is happening and what could happen next. You can find it at thetimes.co.uk or every Sunday in print. The producer today was Ed Halford. The executive producers were Edward Drummond and Kate Ford. And sound design and theme composition was by Mauro Seto. If you can, leave us a nice review wherever you're listening to us. It'll help other people find us. You can contact us as well, thestory@thetimes.co.uk. Goodbye.